The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Allen Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia, New Jersey. Welcome back to Inside Medicine, our weekly way to get up to date in medical issues. So let me just start off with a second here. Quote, I want to acknowledge CVS Caremark for announcing last month that it will limit certain first-time opioid prescribers to seven-day supplies, among other important reforms. My impression is that's going to be a bit of a disaster. Have you ever told somebody in severe pain that they're only going to get seven-day supply, especially if you're trying to get your medication from a long-distance pharmacy? So I congratulate them for the idea of trying to get a seven-day supply to make sure that people don't like their opioids that much. But I think it's going to be a disaster when people can't get their medication. And I'm going to get a million phone calls on Saturday night, Sunday. Can you please renew my seven-day narcotic? Too much. Let me just move to a more reasonable item that doesn't get my ire up. What is plantar fasciitis? So plantar fasciitis is an issue that comes up a lot in my office. And the plantar fascia includes three bands of tissue that support the arch of the foot and connect the heel bone to the toes. Sounds like a radio show. Anyway, this can be incredibly painful. Plantar fasciitis accounts for more than 1 million U.S. clinic visits per year and is most common in adults age 45 to 64. People at higher risk for plantar fasciitis include those with overweight or obesity, defined as a body mass index over 25, and those whose work requires prolonged standing, and those with limited ability to move their toes upward toward their knee, known as the decreased ankle dorsiflexion. I do know my father made sure he had a mat in his store to make sure that his plantar fasciitis was limited as much as possible. Plantar fasciitis can be diagnosed in people who have characteristic symptoms of heel pain that can be felt when condition applies pressure to certain areas of the heel and gently pushes the toes upward toward the knee. People with plantar fasciitis should avoid activities that worsen their pain. Potential treatment options include stretching calf muscles and stretching and massaging the plantar fascia at home during the physical therapy visit. Using orthotics, over-the-counter orthotics provide similar pain relief and are less expensive than custom-made orthotics. But of course, which is better? Wearing a night splint to flex the ankle and extending the toes during the sleep or at other times, if not tolerated during sleep. Receiving a corticosteroid injection in the inner area of the heel, which may provide pain relief for several weeks to months. I like that months. Receive a heel injection of platelet-rich plasma, which is composed of certain components of the patient's own blood and may provide longer-term pain relief than corticosteroid injections. My overall impressions, do that stretch, keep that plantar fascia and calf muscles stretched out, put the toes down and pull that heel back up, use orthotic insoles can be incredibly helpful to make sure that you have a better day. Now, let's just get a little bit of information on GLP-1s. So basically, GLP-1s have hit the scene tremendously. People are slimming down. Injections are getting a little bit less. But we recently had an issue where, due to supply issues, Novo and Lilly could not make enough of their GLP drugs. What happened was people were getting shorted, and the FDA allowed 75 pharmacies to mix and make their own GLP drugs. The problem was last week, Lilly and Novo indicated there is no shortage of GLP-1 drugs now, and the FDA told the pharmacists to invest it in medication to make these GLP-1 drugs at their office were told that they can no longer sell their product. Now, if that isn't a stab in the back, I don't know what it is, but I certainly hope that the FDA will kind of be a little bit more kindly to people who come to the rescue and then get stabbed in the back. My poor pharmacist took a beating. Let me talk about a chronic condition. The global burden of Parkinson's disease is projected to increase in future decades as the number and proportion of older adults increases. For two centuries, Parkinson's disease has been diagnosed clinically on the basis of characteristic motor syndrome, the motor syndrome of bradykinesia, accompanied by resting tremor. They had that shake, rigidity, postural reflex impairment, and largely the result of dopaminergic dysfunction in the nigrostriatal system. I do remember in my dad's store when a patient always came in and he always had a shake, and I was a little bit younger, and I remember asking the sir, how come you have a shake all the time? And my father whacked me behind the head and said, "Be quiet," by hitting that shake. So the incidence and prevalence of Parkinson's disease increases with age, with a male to female ratio of approximately 2-1. When white persons, more so than black or Asian persons, have Lewy bodies detected at autopsy, a hallmark of Parkinson's disease, and has been strong among black persons and white persons. Although the motor syndrome of Parkinson's disease that is attributable to the loss of dopaminergic neurons remains the cornerstone of diagnosis, Parkinson's disease is a multi-system neurologic disorder. Non-motor symptoms include sleep disorder, cognitive impairment, altered mood and affect, autonomic dysfunction, i.e. constipation, urogenital disorders, and orthostatic hypotension, with sensory symptoms of hyposomnia, can't smell. The bottom line is that Parkinson's disease has come a long way, but it hasn't continued to advance at a rapid speed. So Parkinson's disease is a progressive disorder of later life defined clinically by motor features, asymptomatic bradykinesia, rigidity, tremor, imbalance. And on biopsy, Lewy bodies are seen in the central and peripheral nervous systems. Exercise may decrease risk. Gene variants are causation in approximately 20% of cases. Dopaminergic therapies improve motor function, but loss of efficacy and side effects are common. I should note that deep brain stimulation surgery is effective for motor fluctuations. I know that locally here, some patients have been sent up to Robert Wood Johnson in New Brunswick for deep brain stimulation surgery, which has been effective, but it's a tough step. So Parkinson's disease is considered to have multiple causes resulting from both genetic and non-genetic factors. Genetic variants with large effect size have been identified in approximately 20% of persons with Parkinson's disease. The answer is that you kind of have to remember that the medication for Parkinson's disease, when President came in, President Kennedy, he indicated to the FDA he wanted that drug approved quickly, and apparently the FDA did that within a week to try and get dopaminergic drugs for people with Parkinson's disease. Thank God for the president. Regular exercise, healthy diet, high quality sleep, and avoidance of adverse exposures have been associated with reduced mortality and provide a foundation for advancing persons with Parkinson's disease at any stage. Motor symptoms are there. Levodopa can help. Will it fatigue? Possibly. So overall, enough said about Parkinson's disease, but I want to thank again the government for hopping in. Now, what about an issue that came up recently in New England Journal of Medicine? Routine beta blockers and secondary prevention approaching retirement. Nearly half a century ago, trials were performed that provided convincing evidence that long-term treatment with beta blockers can improve outcomes after myocardial infarct. These trials included a high proportion of patients with large myocardial infarcts who had considerably worse prognosis than most patients who are seen today. Larger myocardial infarct, more loss of tissue, more electrical current problems, and reduction in left ventricular ejection fraction, how effective that heart squeeze is. One of these studies, the randomized evaluation of decreased usage of beta blockers after acute MI, called the REDUCE-IT-AMI trial, enrolled patients with myocardial infarctions and a left ventricular ejection fraction of at least 50% who were undergoing coronary angiography. If clinically indicated, receipts of beta blockers did not reduce the risk of death or myocardial infarcts than primary composite outcome. But basically, there was a clinical benefit. The issue is it's come a long time. And the question is, who should remain on beta blockers? Now, beta blockers are an amazing group of drug. They slow your heart rate. They can take away tremors. And the question is, can they also help one maintain the amount of muscle that your heart has? So in this trial, 3,600 patients with a previous MI and a left ventricular ejection fraction of at least 40%. That means they could get out every time the heart squeezes, they get out 40% of the blood, were randomized either to stop or continue beta blockers. During a three-year follow-up period, the investigators found that interruption of beta blocker treatment did not meet the pre-specified non-inferiority margin as compared with beta blocker continuation regarding the risk of death, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, or rehospitalizations for cardiovascular issues. The interruption of therapy also did not improve patient-reported quality of life. Although the strategy of stopping beta blockers was apparently safe, it was associated with an increased risk of angina, leading to hospitalizations and coronary procedures. The question is, can beta blockers be discontinued if someone has a good ejection fraction after their heart attack, i.e. they call it preserved LV ejection fraction, and what would happen those who had undergone angiography and had at least a 50% ejection fraction, which is quite good. So would the beta blockers work? Among the patients with myocardial infarction and a preserved LV ejection fraction, the findings of the, quote, REDUCE-IT-AMA trial placed the use of beta blockers for secondary prevention squarely on the injured reserve list. In April 2024, the results of the current trials will provide additional evidence whether or not the use of these drugs in this population may be approaching final retirement. So beta blockers take away tremors, beta blockers control heart rate. The question here now is there's a challenge to what was found years ago, and will the patients need the beta blocker? So my impression is medicine looks not only backward but forward, and when it does so, it can result in a change in position. The question is, if it's you, will you keep your beta blocker going, which you've worked, which has done well so far, or will you discontinue the product? Discuss it with your cardiologist. Let me bring up a nice little caveat. So Hiba Kusha, winner of a Nobel Prize. So Nihon Hidekanko, a group which is considered a group of survivors of the atomic bombs dropped by the U.S. on Nagasaki and Hiroshima in 1945, was recognized with a Nobel Prize. Congratulations to him and his buddies. The group formed in 1956 sends Hiekabusha, the name given to blast survivors. Anybody who lived, remember if what I was told, that the dust was about 5 feet tall after those cities were bombed. The Nobel Committee chairman said that those testimonials had contributed greatly to the establishment of nuclear taboo, and this individual received the Nobel Prize. Hats off to him and the people who were so good at giving credit to and acknowledgement to those who were lost. Let us change a little bit to lipids. So we were talking about beta blockade, but now we're talking about lipids, one of Dr. Fallon's favorite deals. So practical pearls, navigating the patient roadmap through effective care. Items under consideration include how individual patient concern, type of health services needed, ideally in discussion with a primary care provider, and a shared decision-making product, i.e. see a family doctor and discuss. Ascertain to what extent the individual's health insurance covers particular services, such as co-payments, and what benefits will the plan survive. One of the bands we always talk about lately now is calcium scores with people who are interested in seeing if they have any progression of plaquing in their coronary arteries. the $125 or $150 that people are paying now is out of their pocket. But I have to say this, that a number of my patients have benefited from knowing how much calcification they have in their arteries, and they can be sent to a cardiologist and have intervention done or assessed or decided upon. So what extent does the doctor has to figure out what extent does the health insurer cover a particular service? Are there co-payments, et cetera? How is one going to investigate the rights for the patient and to receive certain benefits? Locate the information of the quality of a particular health service. What do we have to do to get that approved? I was on the line yesterday for someone with one of their pituitary hormones. It's $40,000 a year, but they held me up for a year and a half, an hour and a half. I didn't curse. Be aware of the rules and requirements for assessing and using particular healthcare system. What are the what does it take to get a referral to the proper person? How are appointments booked, et cetera? How can we make sure that your lipids are assessed and taken care of aggressively? We do note that the lipid therapy has really made a significant impact. So have things such as beta blockers, we think, and so have other items. So if the lipid panel results are abnormal, is there a need to be referred to a specialist? So you're at your doctor's office. The doctor says you need lipids intervention. Now, the question is, should the doctor send you to a lipid specialist? Is there a lower cost alternative for laboratory test? In other words, there's tiers of assessing how good someone's coronary arteries are. So does the person have to get the more advanced testing or a screening test? Would it be sufficient to get the doctor and the patient where they want to go? Is there an entire care team, i.e. able to assess all these test results, notes, and recommendations? When the numbers come in, sometimes there's 20 variables. What are the individual target values for lipids and other testing? What are the specific individual recommendations for achieving cholesterol goals? When you're the patient, you have to ask, what should my LDL be? If the average person has an bad cholesterol of 145, should I be better than 145? The other issue is, should I be better than, say, an LDL cholesterol of 74? We do note that the Cleveland Clinic recommends that patients' LDLs be reduced to 74. Will that require one or two or maybe three lipid drugs? Will the insurance company pay for that? Will your doctor have to get on the phone and indicate that this is the appropriate test and convince the guy on the other side who's getting paid, I think, to make sure that people don't get the stuff? What will happen? Okay, then you have to think about with the pharmacist. Does the pharmacist recommend that you get a generic option or that you get a trade option? If the medication is not doesn't have a generic, then there's only one choice, to take the trade. But we can see in cardiovascular disease, there's many options for doctors to pick and, of course, to discuss with their patients. Our manufacturer. Coupons available? Does the patient have to get on the line? Do other pathways exist for obtaining medications, such as cost plus drugs, plus good RX? How are you going to survive making sure that you get the best deal possible? And if it just takes your time and, say, moving on to Amazon drugs, maybe you might want to do that. What discount cards are available? Who should be contacted if there's concern about adverse reactions to the medication? One of the things that burns people is when they buy a drug that's expensive, find out after two doses that they can't tolerate the medication, and then their money is it's out of pocket money, which of course can be very financially not the best thing to do. Patients do get mad when they get a drug they can't tolerate, and regretfully, you just can't predict that if you're a physician. It happens not that often, but it happens. And how is the best way to get refills? Is someone going to get a quick go to the pharmacy act and then go to their 800 number pharmacy? Some patients are strapped and they'll tell you that I'm going to wait till the 800 number pharmacy can get it to me. And you just kind of hate that, especially if somebody has an acute issue. Payer, does the individual insurance plan cover a yearly screening cholesterol blood test? I hope so. but once a year would be certainly a good idea. Remember, the blood test doesn't tell you what's inside those coronary arteries. Are there plaquing? How much plaque do you have? How tight is the plaque? In other words, or how unstable it is. If cholesterol levels are abnormal and the primary care provider thinks a specialist is needed, what is the referral process? I get about every 2 days two requests for a cardiology assessment, and I'm glad to pass them out. But some people have done their own homework ahead of time, which I encourage. And if I don't agree with them, then we have a little bit of a hubbub, but that's okay. The patient wins, and as long as they go and get some care, I'm happy. So the issue is that we want to make sure that how someone deals with a diagnosis of heart disease is treated, and we think that that can be fantastic help. Now, I do want to give a positive out. I want to acknowledge CVS Caremark for announcing last month that it will limit certain first-time opioid prescriptions to 7-day supplies. So in other words, if you get an RX from Dr. Fallon and it's for 30 days and the pharmacy says you only get 7, that's what CVS is going to say. It's going to be a shootout for sure. Pain hurts, and that's what it's called. And 7 days is a great idea. It indicates to the patient that opioids can be dangerous. We want to make sure that nobody gets addicted. But when you're in pain, you don't like to have someone tell you that you got to come back and get another RX or have your doctor call in another RX. And will they give you 30 days? The answer is a lot of times, no. So this is a new one, health and the 2024 U.S. election. The Biden-Dole Act of 1980, March, indicates the principle that the government funds, and when a government funds an invention, then the public should enjoy the benefit of using that invention. It's called march-in rights, allow the government to demand an invention developed with government dollars be licensed to a third party, including when the invention has not been put to practical use or when necessary to meet societal health needs. The federal government has never exercised its, quote, march-in rights. In December 8th of 2023, the Biden administration proposed a framework for U.S. agencies to utilize march-in, laying the groundwork for the federal government to assist in the generation of pharmaceutical and other goods that the public cannot sufficiently assess. This viewpoint explores the proposal and clarifies for physicians and the biomedical industry the likely impact of U.S. drug prices, which is an issue. The Biden administration proposed framework for march-in rights provides guidance on when march-in is appropriate and signals a willingness from the executive branch to use its statutory powers. The U.S. government's hesitancy toward using its march-in rights may stem from warnings from the pharmaceutical industry that the use of these rights will undermine future research and development of life-saving drugs by rendering producers unable to recoup the cost of developing and producing pharmaceuticals. Certainly an issue, but there should always be a compromise in this, according to me. The refrain is common one in response to drug legislation. So the Biden administration's march-in proposal is meant to address high drug prices is widely acknowledged. Sympathetic patients clamoring for improved access to life-saving drugs like insulin, which we just saw, was reduced to $25 a vial. That's a vial, not a pen. Antiretrovirals, chemotherapy have struck a chord with the U.S. public. There is a powerful resistance now from the pharmaceutical industry, which is understandable. And the Inflation Reduction Act's empowerment of Medicare to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies over drug prices has been met with at least 11 lawsuits by major pharmaceutical companies. Under the Trump administration, the U.S. Department of Commerce, National Institute of Standards and Technology disclaimed the use of march-in solely to reduce drug prices. So again, we have an issue where what is the public who has invested in a drug's development being, what is their access to that drug? So the reduction to practice either the inventor has not complied with domestic manufacturing requirements which apply U.S. government funds. So what is happening now is we're going to see what happens to the Biden administration, the ability to share in the rewards of something that the U.S. government invested for all the patients. So it's overall considered a step in the right direction. A willingness from the executive branch to use its statutory powers, if only occasionally, to reduce drug price of pharmaceuticals sounds like a good deal for the public. And hopefully the two parties can get together and make sure that everybody benefits and everybody gets paid for what they do. So each is entitled to payment. Now we're going to move a little bit to something called diabetic retinopathy. So does your doctor take a peek in your eyes when you go see him if you have diabetes, or do you get a yearly check that eye? Certainly ophthalmologists are fantastic at this, but the people who are seeing patients over and over again frequently will check eyes. And the issue is, if you're a diabetic, the physician is looking to see if you have diabetic retinopathy, which is the leading cause of blindness in patients with diabetes. In 2020, more than 103 million individuals with diabetes mellitus worldwide were affected. Affected by diabetic retinopathy. There'll be 160 million people affected by 2024. Compared with all other leading causes of blindness, diabetic retinopathy is the only condition that has not experienced a decrease in age-standardized prevalence between 1990 and 2020. Without proper intervention and management, the burden of diabetic retinopathy will continue to grow, placing more patients at risk for complications that can cause severe vision loss, such as diabetic macular edema and proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So when the doctor looks in your eyes, are these little vessels just emanating, coming out of the back of the eye, indicating that you have proliferative diabetic retinopathy, which is really an emergency and needs an ophthalmologist to hop on in and basically limit the growth and decrease the growth of those aberrant vessels that weren't there before they had diabetes. I do note that in the JAMA article from August of 2024, the statement, key points, primary care physicians should implement the American Diabetes Association screening guidelines and consider leveraging new technologies to ensure patients who require ophthalmologic care are effectively referred to an ophthalmologist. Glycemic control, that's blood sugar control, is crucial for preventing progression of diabetic retinopathy and can be more easily achieved using new diabetic therapies. There's going to be a catch here coming up, is going to be what's the bug with the GLP-1s and eyes. Diabetic retinopathy and diabetic macular edema are primarily treated with antivascular endothelial growth factors that are administered based on diabetic retinopathy staging and the presence of center-involved diabetic macular edema as determined by optical coherence tomography. No wonder the ophthalmologists have an edge on this one, even though vocabulary is tough. So diabetic retinopathy is classified as non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy and proliferative diabetic retinopathy based on the absence or presence of abnormal new blood vessels growing in the retina. So what's happening is, if you take a look in that eye and you get through that disc, are you going to see new vessels, little vessels, which basically tend to go randomly and they tend to be not as strong as regular vessels and can break and bleed. So if you take a picture of it, you'll see these little optic humps and indicate that intervention is needed. So patients who have lowered their hemoglobin A1Cs to less than 6.5 for at least 3 months while off glucose-lowering medications would be considered in remission for diabetes mellitus. So let me just say that again. Anybody, and of course you got these GLP drugs out, they're losing weight, but they're getting better diabetic numbers. Patients who have lowered their hemoglobin A1C to less than 6.5% for at least 3 months while on glucose-lowering medications would be considered in remission from diabetes mellitus. We do want to point out that pregnancy increases the risk of the development and progression of diabetic retinopathy. I'll never forget the gal who developed diabetic retinopathy, who was pregnant. This was her first child, and she basically said, "Keep on going. I'm gonna keep the baby," because the recommendation from ophthalmology was that she was most likely going to lose her vision, which she did. A tough kid. That's all I can say. So what the eye doctor does, he takes retinal photography. They shine a fantastic light, focus it. It can be an ophthalmologist, an optometrist. And there's even special algorithms that can be done with a machine brought into a doctor's office to assess the back of the eye. So just to make sure you ain't the one who's got it, the American Diabetes Association screening recommendations for diabetic retinopathy is different for different populations. Type 1, they recommend within 5 years after onset of type 1, you have an annual exam. Type 2, at time of diagnosis for type 2, they've already been around the block. They recommend it to be seen as on diagnosis and then annually. Pre-existing diabetes and planning on pregnancy, before pregnancy. Got to get it. You want to make sure that you don't have to say, I'm willing to give up my vision. Get checked out every trimester and up to 1 year postpartum. The patient should have a ophthalmologic examination. We do note that initial eye examination is not necessary for gestational diabetes when you get that when you become pregnant. Those babies do put a little pressure on mom. So retinopathy predicts diabetes outcome. Diabetic retinopathy is associated with major systemic complications of diabetes. Its presence and severity has been shown to predict stroke, myocardial infarct, and death. So in other words, if your vessels are being formed new, they are not going to be as good as when God did it initially, and they can break, and then you're going to see somebody with blood pouring out. It's not that great, but it basically does significant damage. Diabetic retinopathy is also associated with diabetic nephropathy, where the kidneys get involved, and diabetic neuropathy, where your ability to sense and feel is affected, and I would say affected also. Primary care physicians can help decrease the risk of diabetic complications by referring patients for comprehensive eye examination and manage associated morbidities and comorbidities. So if your family doctor says get it checked out, I would vote go. So strict glycemic control has been established as absolute key in preventing diabetic retinopathy progression. The Diabetes Control and Complication Trial reported that strong relationship between risk of diabetic retinopathy and mean A1C, a decrease of 10% in A1C results in a 39% decrease in diabetic retinopathy progression. So why do you go? Why do they give you attention to the back of your eye and hit those blood vessels with the laser? A decrease of about 10% in A1C resulted in a 39% decrease in the risk of diabetic retinopathy progression. Do you want to get on another diabetic pill? Do you want to recheck your diet? Do you want to use a GLP-1? I do want to point out that has a risk, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. What about dyslipidemia? Elevated serum cholesterol and triglyceride levels have been implicated as risk factors for diabetic retinopathy. The action to control cardiovascular risk in diabetes, ACCORD trial, investigated intensive glycemic control and treatment of dyslipidemia in patients with type 2 diabetes. The glycemic control was also combined with a drug, phenofibric acid, and simvastatin to assess the effect. That was the study was called the FIELD study. I remember everybody was getting ready and their ear by the telephone to see if the FIELD study came out positive in terms of how well it could do with retinopathy. Despite uncertainties about the effect of statin and fibric therapy on diabetic retinopathy outcomes, multiple trials have shown the benefits of statin therapy and lipid control for overall management of diabetes, including decreased risk of atherosclerotic coronary vascular disease, coronary artery disease, and all-cause mortality. So remember, if you have a tip-off that you have diabetic retinopathy, you want to definitely think about your vessels. You want to make sure that you can get something like a statin drug, which can reverse it, reverse the atherosclerosis. So for 15 cents a day, these drugs are now generic. Grab your atorvastatin, grab your simvastatin, grab whatever statin you can get, and your results will be incredibly better. 15 cents a day doesn't sound bad to me. So what about glucagon-like 1 peptides, which we talk about, the GLP-1s, and hemoglobin A1C reduction in retinopathy? So there is an increased risk for diabetic retinopathy seems to occur early in treatment and be transient, ranging from 3 months to 3 years after starting a GLP-1 receptor agonist. So again, what we've seen is that when you get a GLP-1 drug, the weight peels off. hopefully, and usually. We want to make sure that your sugar goes down, usually. And we want to see what happens to those eyes. So there's an early increase in risk of diabetic retinopathy when GLP-1 receptor agonists are given. And it's necessary to monitor that diabetes and, of course, to monitor the eyes. Statistical analysis shows that the magnitude, but not the rapidity of reduction of A1C was a significant risk factor for early worsening of diabetic retinopathy, especially in the first 6 months. So again, it's necessary to get your family doctor, your endocrinologist, and your retina doctor, which is usually something other than the regular family doctor, but all four can get involved to make sure that your vision stays good, your perk and pop stays good, and you come out a winner. Now, it's always important for the physician to assess patient adherence as pan-retinal photography is done, and is usually done within 6 months. And the goal is how has there been a reduction in that diabetic retinopathy effect? We do know that intravitreally injected steroids are effective in treating diabetes, retinopathy, visual acuity gains similar to anti-VEG treatment. However, because of the risk of elevated intraocular pressure and cataract progression, intraretinal steroids are second-line therapies. So again, laser therapy is good. There is an incredible ability of the local retina specialist, especially who care for diabetes, to take action and to make sure that people will have no loss of vision and do much better. So, sorry about that. So the question comes up here, the National Lipid Association, which is a society that promotes optimal cardiometabolic health, had a recent publication that was actually very good. They stress, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death worldwide, and uncontrolled lipids are a major modifiable risk factor for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. So uncontrolled lipids are a major modifiable risk factor. That is true. Statin therapy remains the cornerstone of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, yet optimal lipid control remains suboptimal. So how good is everybody doing? I at least hope you take your lipid drug every day. I also want to point out that there's different medications now that are available. They're much more potent than statins, and if you need it, you can get it. So here we go. Current U.S. guidelines recommend adding statin medications in patients whose LDL cholesterol remains above specific thresholds despite maximally tolerated statin drugs. Non-statin drugs such as propertine convertase subtilium, PCSK9 monoclonal antibody, evoclumab and elotuzumab, and small interfering RNA particle inclisiran, and the adenosine triphase citrate ACL inhibitor bempedoic acid are effective in lowering LDL cholesterol, but their cost may be a little bit stringent. So let me just say this, that with my patients, the ability to lower cholesterol, even if the statin drug doesn't work, and probably the statin drugs work 90% of the time, we have drugs that can take action and prevent the consequences of hyperlipidemia. So think about those eyes, think about those toes. Really good results today. So when you hear drugs like inclisiran, that's an infusion. It works. We have a number of drugs that now can work if statins don't work. Obviously, if the statins work, we're in good. The goal here is to hit an LDL cholesterol of 74. Check your lab work, see where you're at. Several classes of lipid-lowering medications are available as generic medications, thank God, including statins, of course, leading to lower drug costs for patients with and without prescription drug insurance. So 15 cents a day, you ain't got insurance, you still come up with the 15 cents, you're a winner. Despite being available as generic medications, some statin and non-statin medications may still require substantial copay and may be unaffordable for some patients. There are several potential options to reduce the cost for generic lipid-lowering medications, including pharmacy coupon cards, and using affordable pharmacies to fill generic prescriptions. What about pharmacy coupon cards? Numerous pharmacy coupon cards are available. Don't Don't forget to look under that covers and find that card. Good RX, Well RX, single care are available for patients with and without prescription insurance, but cannot be used in addition to prescription insurance. You only get one way. These coupon cards are typically free to patients and can be used to reduce cost of both branded and generic medications. Note that that's branded and generic. Alternate pharmacies. Select pharmacies, depending on geographic region, offer many generic medications at low cost, which may be especially useful for patients without insurance or those who have a high copay despite prescription coverage. Let me give the kudos to a few pharmacies. Walmart Pharmacy offers a fixed price for several lipid-lowering medications, simvastatin, Zocor, gemfibrozole, that's for the triglycerides, phenylfibric acid for the triglycerides, as 30 or 90-day supplies. Kroger Pharmacy also offers low-cost 30 and 90-day supplies for several statins, Atorva, Prava, and Simva. So you got your range. You got one that's highly fat-soluble, one water-soluble, and one that reduces your lipids by 45%. Thirdly on the list, the Mark Cuban Cost Plus online pharmacy is another option to save on generic lipid-lowering medications, including most statins, Zetia, omega-3 and ester and ethyl esters, which are on the market. Patients must create an account for this online pharmacy and pay a small monthly fee. What a savings. Other options for cost savings. Patients treated with basically these items are important for everybody who doesn't have insurance. Patients treated for hyperlipidemia are likely to have other comorbid conditions such as hypertension and diabetes. Utilizing combination medications which contain two or more medicines in a single pill may be another way to reduce costs by requiring only one copay. Dr. Fallon hates it because when you have three drugs in one pill, who's doing what? So the follow-up, we can do it. Multiple combination pills are available to treat hypertension and diabetes. Like I said, they put a blood pressure pill in and a diabetic pill at the same time. There is even a combination product which includes atorvastatin, a commonly used antihypertensive drug, amlodipine, which is available as a generic formulation. So there you go, blood pressure and statin drug. What about manufacturing coupons? Check it out. Medication cost assistance is available from U.S. pharmaceutical manufacturers for most brand name medications dispensed from a pharmacy in the form of prescription drug discount coupons. These coupons may include a one-time voucher for a 30-day free trial and subsequent saving cards, which allow for savings up to the designated dollar amount each month. Re-enrollment is required on a periodic basis, typically annually. Manufacturing coupons are only available for patients with commercial insurance plans and cannot be used for patients enrolled in state or federally funded insurance plans, i.e. Medicare Part D, Medicaid, Medigap, Veterans, Department of Defense programs, or TRICARE, due to potential violation of federal anti-kickback statutes. Too bad we didn't get rid of them. Certain states, including Massachusetts and California, have banned the use of copay coupons on prescription medications with generic equivalent to lower prescription drug costs by discouraging use of high-cost brand drugs. Medications with generic equivalents, including PCSK9 drugs, modulating therapies, and other agents listed, are excluded from regulations. So let's talk about a new one. Inclisiran is not dispensed from a pharmacy, but covered by a medical benefit plan, and outpatient administration of Inclisiran is given, I think, every 6 months. This drug is incredibly effective. I've had people show up with LDL cholesterol less than 100. With that medication, you get it every 6 months, an injection, and incredibly efficacious. Technology is certainly coming around the corner to help people live longer and better. If your lipids can't be controlled, ask your doctor about Inclisiran, Inclisiran. There are also patient assistance programs sponsored by drug manufacturers as a resource to help patients with limited income receive branded medications for little or no cost. Importantly, PAPs can be used for patients with a variety of prescription drug coverages, including Medicare D and prescription drug insurance. So again, we have another option. There's also 340B drug pricing, which is an assistant program. Medicare Part D Extra Help is available. In conclusion, from what I call the National Lipid Association's fantastic printout, multiple lipid-lowering medications are now available to appropriately address atherogenic lipoproteins and reduce atherosclerotic coronary vascular risk. However, utilization of these medications may be limited by cost. Several resources are available to reduce medication costs and are outlined above. Depending on the type of prescription insurance, manufacturer coupons, and patient assistance programs are available for nearly all branded lipid-lowering medications and can substantially reduce medication costs, which certainly helps out making availability people to live longer and better. So let me just available cost-saving options for brand-name lipid-lowering medications. Bempedoic acid has a manufacturing coupon available. PCSK9s have eligibility or is available too. Inclisiran, we already talked about, that can be through Novartis Patient Assistance Foundation. It applies to U.S. residents only. Eligibility is based on annual household income. And then there is Evinacumab, which is available commercially for insured patients who are U.S. residents. All right. So let me just talk about a very interesting topic. And I have to give credit again to the lipid insights provided by the National Lipid Association. I'm using their material. Navigating the world of nutraceuticals and dietary supplements, a look at all the costs associated with nutraceutical and dietary supplement use for cardiovascular disease prevention. They're going to give you a case to start off. A 62-year-old woman with a past medical history significant for prediabetes, i.e. coming around the corner, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and obesity presented to her primary care physician for her routine 6-month follow-up. She recently became more proactive about her health, given one of her colleagues recently had a myocardial infarction. That'll get you going. In addition to reducing her red meat consumption and walking in the evening, thank God, she started taking a red rice yeast product dietary supplement after reading about possible benefits of red rice yeast on lowering cholesterol. She is interested in learning what additionally she can do to lower her risk for future cardiovascular disease. On examination, her blood pressure was topside but normal, 142/88. Her pulse was 73. Her BMI was 31.2. The goal, of course, is to get less than a BMI of 30. The remainder of the physical examination was normal. Her medication was low-dose lisinopril, 10 milligrams a day, which is a little bit too low. Multivitamin, 1 tablet a day. Red rice yeast, 1 tablet a day. Where did she get her red rice yeast? Total cholesterol, if you want to play this game, 221, goal beat 200. Triglyceride, 165, goal to get preferably under 135. HDL cholesterol, 38, like to get it higher. Bad cholesterol, 150, boo hiss. We want to definitely get those LDLs down to 74. The payoff, according to the Cleveland Clinic, is significant, and I concur. Her A1C was non-diabetic at 6.3, and her renal function was 63 cc's per minute. She had an atherosclerotic cardiovascular risk of 7.6% over a 10-year period based on the prevent risk calculator, and a 12.9% based on pooled cohort risk assessments. So the doctor will tell the patient she certainly can benefit from rallying to beat some of these one of these lab results. The relationship between HDL and cardiovascular disease is well established. Data from 2017 to 2020 National Health and Nutrition Examination found the prevalence of Americans with a total cholesterol greater than 200 and an LDL greater than 130 to be 34% and 25%. Despite this, only 44% of eligible adults over 21 were receiving prescription and treatment for that blood cholesterol. So remember, the total is over 200, the LDL is over 130. One contributor to this undertreatment may be growing public interest in nutraceuticals and dietary supplements to reduce one's risk of heart disease. Here comes the red rice yeast, which I hate. Nutraceuticals and dietary supplements are now a multi-billion dollar global industry. More than half of adults over 20 of age in the United States reported taking a dietary supplement. That's only 58%. Making money outside of the pharmacy in the pharmacy. Social media influencer promotion, ease of access via online purchasing, and distrust in the medical field likely contribute to the increasing popularity of nutraceuticals and dietary supplements. The U.S. Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act defines a dietary supplement as a product that is taken by mouth as a pill, capsule, or liquid that contains one or more dietary ingredients meant to supplement the diet, not to be used as conventional food or sole diet. Although the terms of dietary supplement nutraceuticals are often used interchangeably, it is perhaps to think nutraceuticals as a subcategory of dietary supplements. Nutraceuticals are nutrient-rich dietary substances made from whole food or parts of food sources. Unlike prescription drugs, dietary supplements are not required to undergo a pre-marketing approval or post-approval studies by the United States FDA. So notice that the FDA is not getting involved. They're basically the watchdog to make sure you don't get a bad deal. The responsibility to demonstrate efficacy and safety is deferred largely by the manufacturer, so you ain't got no guarantee. The lack of oversight allows manufacturers to potentially embellish the effectiveness. I hope we don't have to look up embellishment of the product while withholding uncertainties that exist due to the lack of rigorous research required for a product to come to the market. This also poses the risk for batch-to-batch variability, i.e. how good is our manufacturing, and will you get the same product all the time? Dietary supplement and nutraceutical use also carries the risk of adverse effects intrinsic to their ingredients and potential drug-drug interactions. Both efficacy and safety concerns around dietary supplements and nutraceuticals are highlighted using some of the more popular classics below. Table 1 compares the cost of some of these common supplements. So they're going to start off with red rice yeast. Red rice yeast is the result of rice ferment with a mold during which bioactive monocolins are created, which weakly inhibit HMG coagonist reductase. I know they work not as well, but by far as a statin drug would. So the red rice yeast at doses of 1.2 to 4.8 grams a day can decrease LDL, the bad cholesterol, triglycerides to a certain degree. Some people say 20% decrease in LDL cholesterol and a 4.7% reduce in absolute risk. Let me tell you, that is one. In my patients who took red rice yeast, which frequently comes from China and is associated with carcinogens, don't get that kind of result. But it's on the market and stated. Recently, red rice yeast supplement produced by Kobashi Pharmaceutical was linked to 114 hospitalizations and 5 deaths in Japan from suspected nephrotoxicity due to a product contamination with pubiulic acid. So again, do you want to try red rice yeast? Don't recommend it. What about omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids? I'm just looking it up. We're coming to the end. I got about 2 more minutes. I will tell you this, that this is, if you want to read about this, it's got more data. It's www.lipid.org/lipid-spin/summer-2024/case-study-navigating. So again, the good news is that heart disease is here, but heart disease can be beat. Remember that these medications that are out here have improved dramatically. Everywhere I look, I see better lipid results. Remember, the Cleveland Clinic's motto is get to 74 and I'll save you 43% of your bad cardiovascular outcomes. So we didn't get through everything, but I do want to talk about real quick. I do note that there was a fantastic publication in the New England Journal of Medicine. Experimental and clinical evidence supports the role of inflammation in atherosclerosis and its complications. Colchicine is an orally administered potent anti-inflammatory medication that is indicated for the treatment of gout and pericarditis. The bottom line is it looks like colchicine is going to come alive again. We usually use it for gout, and I intend on getting an expert to come in and talk on Inside Medicine about the potential for colchicine to decrease myocardial infarction side effects. So Dr. Fallon here, we will be coming back next week. I want to thank everybody for hopping on in. Inside Medicine, we have a podcast, www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine, and there's 125 podcasts up. Please check it out. There's a lot to learn, and I want to thank everybody for listening in. Joe Fallon will be signing off. Catch you guys next week. Again, www.wwdbam.com. Hit podcast, Inside Medicine, and there's 125 there. Thank you very much. Joe Fallon signing off. See you guys next week.